With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Hey, what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball. Look, I can dispense with the pleasantries. Let's just get to some of the stuff we've seen in college basketball. A couple of things is, in this past week, we've seen Arkansas take down Duke and Kansas beat UConn. The Kansas-UConn game was a great basketball game, if possible. And I know UConn fans will forever say, you know, we got screwed in the officiating, and that happens when you're in the fog. I don't think the officiating was terrible. Hunter Dickinson is a hard guy to officiate. He's incredibly physical and he does complain a lot, but he is a very talented player, and big guys in many ways are at a disadvantage in terms of how the game is officiated these days, especially guys that score in the low post, because you can be so physical in the low post and yet you can't be physical out on the court or sometimes in screening situations. So the first thing is that those are two places, and I know there's others. I watched the Xavier-Houston game. Xavier's always an incredible place. That I know it's like chicken or the egg, but I'll give you an example. I'm doing consulting work with Oklahoma State this year, and granted, Oklahoma State has not had the recent success of Arkansas, definitely not had the success of Kansas, but a once proud fan base, you know, you end up having 6,000-7,000 people for Creighton, a ranked team, to come in and play. And the difference is, or maybe you go to any of these games, it's really weird how fans are in most places, not all places, the basketball places, it's not this way, but in most places it's show me. Now, look, I grant you that Arkansas getting Duke on their home floor is a pretty special night, but like Arkansas have been struggling. You know, they were like a 500 team. And so to have your biggest crowd ever in Fayetteville, granted it's for Duke, in many ways, that's the difference in winning and losing games. And it's like, well, if you'd win more, we'd show up more. But if you'd show up more, we'd win more. And I think there's a lot of there's just truths to that are undeniable. But let's dig in on a little bit of the meat. What's wrong with Duke? Because Duke turned around and lost to Georgia Tech, two straight road games. First, there's home and road in college basketball. And I love that John Shire is unlike his predecessor, Mike Krzyzewski. But some of it is it's out of conference scheduling, right? That's the ACC, SEC showdown. So they had to go on the road. But, you know, how often, it's a celebration for all things that Duke has accomplished when they go on the road and they're the biggest game that team has been. And Arkansas is a proud program, the biggest program you could ever see. And there's a couple things. I think one, probably still playing too many guys. And a lot of coaches I speak with are in that same boat where, you know, part of this I'm sure is the portal. I'm not going to let some be in denial of how things work in that. You just can't lose everybody every year, and you make some promises, and I'm sure there's some NIL directed at a bunch of different players, and you're like, look, we allocated resources to this player. We have to at least see what he can do. And so it causes you, this is a lot like in AAU basketball, where you got payers and you got players, you know, and like, well, this kid came to practice all week, and this kid's dad, you know, pays to the team band, and this, you know, we got to, now, it's obviously different, but you know, when you're around these programs enough, there is at least a very small portion, a portion of, hey, who do we take a look at and in what situations, at least a portion of it is some of the NIL stuff and the transfer portal stuff. We don't want to lose everybody every year, and we definitely don't want to lose half of our team checking out because we're only playing seven guys or six guys to start the season. That said, there's other reasons. One is you don't really know what you have. And whatever you think you have, you don't know what you have until you play them in front of 18,000 people, because people react differently in front of 18,000 people than they do when it's an empty practice gym and you're going up against a team you know and a ball screen coverage that you're very well aware of how to manipulate. But I think that part of the Duke thing is you're playing too many guys. Part of the Duke thing is you have some really young players. I mean, even Proctor has come back for year two. Like, Filipowski's a stud. Then those guys played a lot last year. But, you know, Proctor wasn't like he was playing 35 minutes, and he's still only a sophomore, and this is a much bigger role. But I think it's all the whirling pieces around that you're trying to figure out. And I thought Eric Musselman did a great job of not guarding the non-shooters for Duke. And look, you, on some level, you have to change how you play when teams play kind of a one-man zone with a shot blocker. I mean, that's having seen that Creighton game up close against Oklahoma State, and I watched all the film leading up to it. That's how they play, right? Where they press up on three or four perimeter players, force everything into the lane, and you got Ryan Kalkbrenner, who's 7'1" and does a great job of not fouling in the lane, kind of daring you to take and make mid-range jump shots or those little floater shots in two-on-ones. And those are the shots you don't necessarily want to take when you're a coach. That's not what you're shooting for. So the first thing for Duke is I think they're playing too many guys, and I think that will work itself out. I do think that if you watch John Shire last year, he seemed to figure out what he had by about this time or into January. And it is inorganic to have conference play. You know, I used to really hate, I don't like conference play this time of year. But you almost wish that everybody had like a four-game conference stretch. I'll give you a scheduling thought in a moment. But anyway, in working back to Duke, playing too many guys, that's really kind of what it comes down to. And you're at this point of the year where once you kind of get to January, you're hoping your freshmen, the good ones, they've evolved some. But you know that the juniors and seniors can kind of carry you. But you have your juniors and seniors for the most part because they're not as talented as guys that have left. That makes any sense, right? I mean, you look around the country and you'll notice that some of the starting lineups are evolving where the younger players are starting to take over. Why is that? Because when they got there, they weren't ready, and they're still probably not ready now, but they have a higher ceiling, or the thought is they have a higher ceiling than the older players. Now, some teams just have older players. They're going to ride or die with them. I think that's what you have from Creighton, for example. But the Duke thing, a lot of it is playing too many pieces. A lot of it is trying to figure out how it's really hard to win with young guys. And people have, you know, because we see Duke a lot, they got him scouted. And, you know, forever this has been an issue with Duke is Duke, and they don't play as much that way defensively. But, you know, there was probably a 10-year span there where Duke, all they did defensively was get up the line and try and pressure you. And it didn't matter who they were playing against. That's how they played, right? That's how they played. Up the line, pressuring everything. Matter of fact, the 2010 team that won the national championship, that was the one team, you know, I'm always going to be the guy that called them alarmingly unathletic. And the crazy part was that they were alarmingly unathletic at that time. Here's the context of it. They played Arizona State, who I think had James Harden in Madison Square Garden. And they got just carved up by Arizona State. And they got carved up because they were trying to pressure everywhere defensively. And they had Nolan Smith and John Shire. They had Kyle Singler as well. So you didn't, it's not like you had the freakiest athletes on earth. And when they changed their lineup and put Brian Zubek in, they played much more back off the line, you know, help-oriented defense where they just mauled you on the glass and with their size in the lane. again, no one's ever gone like, yeah, you know, I mean, the Duke guys have told me, like, of course you were right. But they didn't realize the adjustment, the Coach K adjustment in style mid-season changed forever the trajectory of that team. And Zubac became a dominant big guy for them based upon how they were playing. They couldn't play up the line with the guys they were playing with. So it was one of the reasons that that Greg Paulus struggled in his career. Greg Paulus, a really good player. Really good player. But what he wasn't was a point guard who could really pressure, who could pressure that way defensively. That's just not who he is, was, or will ever be. So the point is that Duke always played one way. And one of the things that coaches run into this time of year is because you haven't self-scouted in practice, right? Even when you play in scrimmages, secret scrimmages, nobody doesn't guard guys. And now you get into games and people get you completely scouted. Some people we're not going to guard. We're not going to go past, you know, the free throw line to make him shoot. Whereas some guys, you know, we're going to change how we play ball screen coverage, whatever. Well, that causes everything you run, you kind of have to tweak and adjust to. And it's not easy. So I'd say that's the other thing is now Duke's being scouted. And as probably the most watched college basketball team or one of the two or three most watched college basketball teams, that's the adjustment they're going to have to make. And then trying to integrate, you know, Caleb Foster in that lineup, who obviously, you know, we always have a guy who in the Champions Classic is a freshman who makes a bunch of shots and we get an unreal sense of who they are. I love Caleb Foster. I saw him last year. He was, you know, those two, Jared McCain and Caleb Foster were two dynamic guards in California. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, Bronny James is so high up on these draft boards, which makes no sense. Those two just dominated him. Caleb specifically when he played against, they played against four times last year in high school, but both of them are just freshmen and, you know, their reputation and their upside demand minutes. But as freshmen, you're going to be super inconsistent and that's what they're running into. And now they're scouted as well. So Purdue loses again to Northwestern. And look, you can lose in conference play on the road. Welsh Ryan is, oh, what a cool place. I mean, just like historically, I hope people understand, and I know it's been open for a while now, but I hope people understand that was the worst gym. It was a gym. Worst gym in the Big Ten by a mile. All the other teams in the Big Ten, I'm trying to think if they've all made kind of the same. You know, Breslin's really good, but you know, you look at what Penn State did where they Rec Hall was like perfect college basketball venue. Now they play in the Bryce Jordan Center. They've done it for 20 years. It's just cavernous. It doesn't make any sense. You know, Wisconsin's place, the Kohl Center is big and they don't lose there often, but there's no real atmosphere there. Ohio State's the Schottenstein Center or whatever. Like, it's just a big, it's like a bad NBA arena. Where what Northwestern did was they gutted the inside and kept it at 7,000 seats, and they just made it an incredible venue. And I can't implore college administrators enough. And like, look, a lot of schools don't have this opportunity, but Oklahoma State's a perfect example, right? Like, that place is awesome. It's 13-6. It's too damn big. You know, it's not just that Oklahoma State hasn't been as good. It's also that there's the Thunder who wasn't there, but just like 7,000 seats is great. A packed arena is great, you know? And I think Northwestern is the best remodel. There and SMU, those are the two best remodels where they took a small gym and instead of falling in love with, hey, we can put a couple more thousand seats or build some new kind of NBA style place where we can get concerts in and whatever. And they do it. And they do those things, obviously, sometimes either to get into a tournament bid or to get to make more money off concerts, but whatever. The ones that just keep it the size, I mean, New Mexico, even they went down, I think 4,000 seats went back when they redid the pit. But Welsh Ryan is awesome. But the warning sign it has for Purdue is kind of, we think that the only way to beat them is with small, was with really athletic guards getting after Braden Smith and with five men who can shoot threes and drag Zach Edey out, because that's what they've lost, you know, last 2 years in the tournament is to low majors. But Northwestern's ability to beat Purdue, granted at home, two consecutive years, watch how the Cats play. You couldn't be happier, Chris Collins. Everyone I know in Evanston last year was like, man, we're going to have to fire Chris Collins, and he's an awesome dude. I was like, well, so why do you have to fire him? Like, well, it's just program's kind of stuck and not really doing anything. And then, of course, they go to the NCAA tournament. And remember, before he got there, they'd never been to an NCAA tournament. But I'm not sure I really understood that whole thing. But they play beautiful basketball in terms of the consistency of their movement within all the actions that they run. And look, they really attack Zach Edey. And Zach Edey, you know, he fouled out like pretty much every big guy that Northwestern had. And yet they just kept coming at him and changing their coverages and trying to limit his paint touches. And they're really quick and, you know, forcing him off the block. And, you know, when he's not 2 to 4 feet away, it's a different game. And he does struggle to move out of his zone. That was an amazing play they ran for him, them to win the game or to send the ball, the game to overtime. They just threw it up to him and he's just bigger than everybody, catches and lays it in with like 0.6 seconds to go. But the point is not that Northwestern can win a home game against the number one ranked team in the country or that they have Purdue's number. It's more, how do they do it? And they did it a different way. Yes, some of their fives can step out and shoot. And they're, you know, those Big Ten teams, they're all loaded up with, you know, 2 or 3 6-foot-10 dudes, so you can throw multiple bodies at them. But I thought it was the movement, the actions, you know, not just getting caught up. So many teams, they say, hey, we want to attack Zach Edey on a ball screen. So they put him on a ball screen, you know, right at the start of every possession. Whereas what Northwestern does is, you know, they really move it around, come in some sleight of hand stuff, and then they get Boo Booey kind of in that 2-on-1 where he's, you know, coming downhill and he's got a great floater game, really good in those middies, and, you know, just a volume of attacks on a big guy. And I think some of that wears him out on the offensive end as well. And then, you know, like, look, Braden Smith is good, but there are times in which he still looks like a sophomore. They don't have a wing who can go get you a bucket. They're not built that way. And, you know, they're a good team that Purdue continues to be a good team that doesn't have an NBA player. Will Zach Edey play in the NBA? Probably. Yeah. I mean, he'd make a ton overseas. Will he play in the NBA? Probably. But you're like, well, what does that matter? Well, when you have a guy who can just, all things are going bad and break you down, and maybe not even an NBA player, like Boo Boo, he's not an NBA player, but he's one of those stud college players who can just end the game. Hey, I'm just going to go get you a bucket. And they're not really built that way. Not really built that way. So I still like Purdue, and I think they can win a national championship, because I don't think this is a year in which the top teams have a lot of those guys, or especially have an older guy like that. But you can see that some of the same old Purdue issues peek their head out at inopportune moments. So my guest today is Jason Belzer. Jason will tell you about his company, all the things that he does, but it's a perfect time to have him in since he truly is an expert in the NIL space, as well as the college coaching kind of space. He's a former student athlete, and he's the founder of AD University. He's a professor of strategy as well and sports law at Rutgers University, and he's also the director of the Jewish Coaches Association. Let's welcome in. He's Jason Belzer.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Jason, let's start with your background in hoops. For the last 10 years, you've done what?
So I have been an attorney in college sports for almost 17 years now, and I represent a whole bunch of college basketball coaches, both on the men's and women's side, helped start the College Insider Tournament, and then built a media company called Athletic Director U, D1 Ticker. Which helped me build relationships with administrators and coaches and all the important people in college athletics.
You went to law school where?
Rutgers. Played football at Rutgers, went to law school at Rutgers.
What was Rutgers football like when you played there?
We were the worst team in the country. We were literally, at the time, I believe there was 120 FBS schools and we were 120. My recruiting trip to Rutgers when I was in high school, we lost to West Virginia 80-7.
So why'd you go there?
Because it was really the only chance I had to play Division I football. Plus, it was a school that was 40 minutes down the road from where I grew up. Or at least FBS football. Now, we got really good really fast. And I wasn't really contributing much to that. But it was, it was a great opportunity to engage and be part of a big time football program, even though we weren't very good, at least initially.
So you're going to law school. Was it always your intention to go into some sort of sports law, some from a sports focus?
Yeah. I mean, I knew when I was an undergrad that I wanted to be an agent, and I actually wanted to be an agent representing student athletes. But you couldn't do that back then. So I said, I'm going to do the next best thing, and I'm going to be an agent that represents college coaches. And I literally just started cold calling and emailing people. You know, I was reaching out to Rick Pitino and, Lute Olson and anybody else that was coaching at the time, trying to get them to let me represent them. I was a 21-year-old kid. Eventually, I caught on. I got some people to join, and that's where I got involved very early on in the Jewish Coaches Association, and started working with some young Jewish coaches like Josh Pastner, who literally just became head coach at Memphis at the time. The rest is history on that end. But even throughout that time, I've always been a tremendous advocate for student athletes and NIL rights. I am like a walking oxymoron. I'm the guy that is helping coaches make millions of dollars, and then at the same time realizing that some of this money should be shared with the student athletes, which is why as NIL started to become more of a reality, I knew that I was maybe the best positioned person on the entire planet to help the industry through what was going to be a very tumultuous time that we are in, and everything that I predicted has happened, and everything that I believe will happen is unfolding here. And we are seeing this before our eyes. We're going to be at revenue share in some capacity within the next 12 to 18 months. No question.
You think? What about the schools where there isn't the revenue?
I don't think it matters. I think you're going to have a subset of about 40 schools that are going to make a decision that is the route that they're going to want to go. That decision will be predicated on a few factors. Number one, either they will make the decision themselves. The decision will be made for them through the court system, through one of these employment or NLRB cases, or the decision will be partially predicated on what Congress passes. I have no I am not going to rely on Congress to do anything. They can't even, get a budget pass, much less save college athletics. And so there's no question that these conversations are already happening. I can tell you that they're happening because I'm involved in some of them about what does this new model look like. We, as an organization, my company, Student Athlete NIL, now works with more than 40 different institutions. We are the largest mover of money in NIL as it relates to rosters than anybody else. We have over 1,000 student athletes under contract. And so the groundwork is there, and we are moving violently towards a new era in whatever it looks like, the semi-professionalization of college sports, even though it's pretty much been semi-pro the last 2 or 3 years. We'll just have some structure around it.
Okay. So in your mind, what does it look like?
In the ultimate and easiest structure, it would be to have these institutions that choose to want to participate in this to agree upon a revenue share. We would start with football, potentially basketball, but football is a much bigger piece, where there is some sort of guaranteed minimum compensation for every athlete on the roster. I suspect that based on what we are seeing in the SEC conference, that number will be an estimated $8 to $10 million for football, meaning that you're looking at about $100,000 for each student athlete. That football and maybe basketball is split off into a professional organization that is licensed underneath the existing athletic department. So it could be Michigan Football LLC or whatever you want to call it. When that happens, the student athletes are likely to be deemed employees unless there's some sort of safe harbor position that is provided by, you know, maybe Senator Cruz or whoever else if the legislation gets through. But by splitting it off, what it does is that it creates a scenario where Title IX no longer applies. Because if my athletes are employees, it doesn't matter. And what ends up happening then is that I can choose to keep my women's teams. I can likely choose to gut them to save money if I need to, which will happen to some capacity. But I don't have to play this nonsense Title IX game if these athletes are actually generating revenue. And then the big question becomes, what happens to all the other sports? What happens to women's sports? What happens to Olympic sports? The reason why SEC schools, and we work with a number of them, and we're paying a number of their payrolls, are trying to drive $8, $9, $10 million a year into their collectives is because they know this is happening. It's going to be here in the next 12 to 24 months. And so they are literally trying to wean themselves off of that money today. They are saying, if we're going to have to operate in a revenue share world in 2 years or 1 year, why are we not trying to figure out how to operate with $10 million less in our budgets today? And let's just allocate those dollars to the student athletes right now. The problem is that there are schools within the SEC, less so the SEC and more so in the Big Ten, that don't have that type of money. And so while the revenues are similar for both conferences, I can tell you that Rutgers and Purdue and Northwestern and Maryland, they don't have the same capacity as Ohio State and Michigan. Everybody knows that. They're not paying the same numbers for NIL. And that's not too different from what's happening in the SEC. I mean, Mississippi State, you know, South Carolina, are they as competitive with LSU and Alabama? They're not.
So, the picture you're painting, though, means, as you said, and this is a very realistic picture, is whenever you pump something up like football, something's going to fall short, like women's sports. How does that work? I mean, I understand you're talking about legally splitting them off, but the reality is that so much of this has been created so that there's equal opportunity. And I just wonder how that plays out in Congress and in the courts.
So how I will give you the solution, but I have some questions for you first, Doug.
Yeah.
How can Congress force any entity to do something? Where's the money going to come from? It's going to be too late by that point, right?
Well, here's where does the money come from is this. As you know, and I know, states give far less to their land-grant universities for sports, if anything, than they ever have previously. But that doesn't stop them from giving money and giving benefits as well to other areas of the school. So that's the threat, right? If you don't do it our way, then you get no funding.
So the University of Arizona that is facing a massive budget crisis is now all of a sudden going to have to come up with an extra $5 million, $10 million to continue to fund their women's programs because Congress said so. That's going to be a disaster. I will tell you what will happen. You may very well be right, Doug. Like, let's play that out. 100% certainty it happens. What will then happen, and this is the likely outcome for all of this, is that you will have a private equity firm come in, and a private equity firm will come and say, I will give you $100 million, I will give you $200 million, $500 million. What is Ohio State football worth? What is Texas football worth? Billions, right? I will give you X number of dollars as an annuity for whatever percentage, 25, 30% of your future revenue. You take that $200-300 million, and then that money and its interest, you know, we'll make you 10% on that, will pay for your women's programs moving forward. And we're good, right? So the school will be forced to sell off. And Doug, take the University of Arizona as an example, because it's low-hanging fruit here. You don't think that the president and the board of trustees of that university, facing an existential crisis, wouldn't take $500 million right now to sell off 50% of their athletics program to save the university? Of course they would. I mean, what is the endowment of Arizona? A billion? Billion and a half? You're going to get 50% of your endowment for a portion of your athletics team? They're going to sell it tomorrow. Rutgers operates at a $25 million loss every year. If they can go raise $500 million, then the university's endowment is $1 billion. They will sell that tomorrow, and it solves all their problems. And as an alum, you know, if Oklahoma State puts out a shingle and says, hey, we're going to go do this, you're going to go put your money in, Doug, right? So am I. Everybody will. Everyone wants to be an owner. You know what the ironic thing is? That's essentially what we're doing with the collectives anyway, right? You're just not actually getting an ownership stake unless you invest into my company. But that's right.
You're getting an ownership stake of a player.
More sure.
But you're not getting any return on it, right? That's right. The only return.
Other than what you're seeing, sure.
What about what happens with the donation game? Does that totally go away?
Well, it's all going to go in-house regardless. I mean, it's already moved in-house in some capacities. We have many mechanisms that we work with universities to be able to manage cash flow. I mean, we are in the transfer portal. We're in day two. And by our estimations, there will be about $400 million that will change hands over the next 45 to 60 days in terms of contracts. We will control the largest proportion of that because of the number of universities that we represent. But this will also be the biggest NIL exchange ever, because the reality is that we probably go to rev share and a lot of that will be absorbed in-house, right? And then donors just, you know, Doug, you keep going to Oklahoma State, and then Oklahoma State will sign its rev share contract with the football and basketball teams, and the donor money will just flow into this university and be one bucket of the revenue share. There's so much more opportunity for real NIL, though, that schools are not taking advantage of. The majority of them are not, because they have poor infrastructure set into place to drive this type of revenue.
When you say real NIL, what do you mean?
I mean, real endorsement, marketing potential. I mean, you know, I'll give an example, Doug. I know you may even not want to hear it, but we work with the University of Oklahoma. And I would say that Crimson and Cream is kicking the butt of whatever Oklahoma State has going on, because we are running a high, you know, functioning, professionalized operation where we have generated in excess of $2.5 million in real NIL non-donor money for OU student athletes over the last 13 months that we've been operating at Oklahoma. What has Oklahoma State been able to generate for their athletes in that same time, not touching donor money? Not a whole lot. right? Real NIL, right? Endorsements, trading cards, marketing appearances, television commercials, membership programs, all of those different things. There is more money in NIL than there is in multimedia rights, because you are not beholden to just one partner. You don't have to just be an exclusive partner of Hal Smith. You can go work with McDonald's and everybody else. That's just part of it, right? And so there's real NIL value. That's what our focus is as an organization. Sure, we're running money from donors, but at the end of the day, we want to build a $1 billion industry that is based on real NIL transactions and the power of the student athlete as an influencer.
Who's the most, what school or schools are the most advanced in the real NIL?
There are a handful. Again, I would say Oklahoma. LSU has done a fantastic job, not on the collective side. They've done an awful job on their collective. They've done a great job in helping provide marketing opportunities for their student athletes. USC has done an okay job, again, not on the collective side, on real NIL. Tennessee has done a pretty good job because of Spire. The difference is that we are a sports marketing company, right? We employ full-time salespeople. We employ full-time business developers. The vast majority of schools are just operating collectives, or they have collectives that are being operated by part-time donors and alumni. And then internally, they have people that aren't real revenue generators. That's also the problem, Doug. College athletics has been based on a ecosystem of money that comes from donors, right? That's why it doesn't phase Texas A&M to go fire Jimbo Fisher and have to go, you know, launder another $75 million in money through their nonprofit status athletics department to go pay it off from donors. These people are not thinking about what the bottom line is. How do we drive real revenue to our student athletes? And so there has been a very, very small amount of money that has come through. Nebraska probably has done a good job because Blake Lawrence, who started Open Doors, is from Nebraska, and he's dedicated a lot of his time to doing that. Oregon, because of Division Street and what Phil Knight has been able to do there. But outside that, most institutions are not doing very much at all when it comes to monetizing the real value of what a student athlete is. Mostly because they're hands off, they don't want to deal with it. And that's why ADs rather retire than go figure out this NIL thing.
All right, that's it for part one. Okay, part two, what are the downsides? What are the downsides? What about women's athletics? And will college athletes actually sit out if they can't get the deal they want when it's collectively bargained for? And we'll get to that in the next episode. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.